that what have you been in the internal world, and maybe the government too in this way, they live in one world and the people live in the other. So the patients live in one world, and what is happening outside don't bother them very much. And it's about the avoidance of contact, avoidance of the other.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Lola Komarova from Moscow. Dr. Komarova is a psychoanalyst in Moscow and served as the president of the Moscow Group of Psychoanalysts. She currently is the director of training there. And in addition to her private practice in Moscow, she teaches a course on applied psychoanalysis for psychology students. What I learned and enjoyed about today's interview is I received a real history lesson. History, so I learned, in Moscow, in Russia, is different than history, certainly for me here in the West. We will hear about not only the stories about the 1960s smallpox epidemic, the 1993 uprising, certainly the collapse of the Soviet Union. We will hear not only about these events, but how they are reawakened in the current crisis, the current health crisis. When we think of the saying, how the past lives in the present, we usually are referring to the childhood, infantile past, how that lives in the present for all of us. But I learned, speaking to a Russian psychoanalyst, that the past that lives in the present is also the political past. It's also the historical past. Because not only do the people there have as a template the collapse of their country and all the terrible uncertainties, but how that collapse informs this dangerous, difficult circumstance they're in and the uncertainty that they're in. So on the one hand, we learn that they are prepared for this uncertainty. And on the other hand, in some ways, this uncertainty is doubly troublesome for them because of what they lived through. I hope you find it as interesting as I do. Here's my conversation with Dr. Lola Komarova. Lola, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you with us. Mm-hmm. Lola, we are learning, the world is really learning, that when we are all faced by a similar crisis, each community responds uniquely. And by community, I mean the geographic community, and also each psychoanalytic community responds uniquely. For example, and you and I are speaking on June 21st, In Europe and in Israel, for example, the psychoanalytic communities are returning, I don't know about quite to normal, but they're beginning to see patients in person. Here in the States, that's generally not happening. And in contrast, in South America, in many countries, things are still getting worse. So the world is really responding both based on the severity of the virus and its exposure, and also by the culture of each community. Start us off by telling us about life in Moscow right now, because we in the West hear probably very slanted information. Give us a feel for what life is like in Moscow, and then we'll talk about what psychoanalysis is like in Moscow.
Okay. So, right now, it seems that life is in Moscow is coming to normal. The lockdown was lifted suddenly, well, some 10 days ago, and it was a week before it was announced. And it was absolutely unexpected. In addition, almost all of the restrictions were cancelled at once, although before the city council had announced an elaborated plan of many stages of gradual withdrawal from the lockdown. And we were threatened with a second wave and said that the life in the city is unlikely to come to normal before the vaccine becomes available. I can only guess why it was done so hastily and contrary to the original intentions. But in retrospect, I think the lockdown was quite an experience. And it seems that the life before this COVID-19 belongs to the distant past, to some another era. And many predict that the world will never be the same, and I think they might be right. We all have gone through some important experience that has changed all of us, and this experience has many dimensions, and it had to be understood and worked through, but I think it's too early. We are not quite out of it now. Well, I can say some of my impressions of how it was during the lockdown in Moscow. What was the dominant mood and how citizens react and how their attitudes changed with the pass of time.
Yes.
So, the initial reaction was shock, and it is no wonder, because the measures taken to contain the spread of the virus were unprecedented, and they implied that the situation was deadly serious. And we have something to compare with, because some people still remember the outbreak of smallpox in Moscow in 1960. And smallpox is a deadly disease. At that time, thousands of people who had contacts were isolated in hospitals, and millions, I think 9 million of citizens, vaccinated in a week or two. However, even then, there was no question of total lockdown. So,
I hadn't realized there was a smallpox epidemic.
Yes, it was quite unexpected and, well, quite serious and threatening situation.
And so this crisis reawakens that for many people, I imagine.
Not for many, but for all the ones, yes.
Yeah. And how did you feel the relation between the community and the government was during this recent episode? Was were they working together? Was there trust? Was there distrust? How did it go?
See, it was different initially when people, you see, like, well, I think at first people were very, very scared, and the media played a part in it because, well, first it was these unprecedented measures, then the media was scaring people, well, translating all these apocalyptic images from around the world, and every hour news broadcast the growing numbers of infected and dead, and journalists start to use military vocabulary. So it's no wonder that people were very scared. Huh. But there were no mass panic, I can say. So while the prevailing mood was fear, most of the citizens were obediently following the orders, and they retreated into the homes. The streets were deserted, and the city looked really surreal. But little by little, the fear of the virus was gradually fading away in the face of more urgent everyday problems. And it was giving way to irritation and fatigue from being trapped in homes, and also by the lack of money and the uncertainty of the future. However, Moscow authorities continued to terrify people with statistics, shame them for some cases of violation of the self-isolation restrictions, and impose new and new restrictions. And when, at one moment, the pass regime was introduced for traveling by public transport, and this measure appeared unreasonable. It had no clear epidemiological sense, but significantly complicated life, which was not easy, particularly for migrants and people from other cities. And this event was the turning point in the people's mind. Their attitude changed, attitude to the authorities' orders changed.
To the point that there is increased tension, you're describing, between the population.
Yes, in a way, but well, the ratings of the mayor dropped disastrously, and the Moscow authorities began to be habitually called the occupation government.
Oh,
and
really?
The term corona bigotry became widespread.
Corona bigotry, is that it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's quite a phrase.
And hardly anyone took seriously the latest of the mayor orders. For instance, the order to take walks strictly in accordance with the established schedule. It rather became a subject of numerous jokes.
Huh.
And apart from it, well, when people seems made their mind then from now on they will survive on themselves, and they are not going to obey any absurd instructions, many hairdresser shops, beauty salons, and even restaurants began operating underground somehow. And what I can say, just to summarize, that there are two popular sayings that catches this, I think, cultural attitude. One is from the 19th century. It is said that the severity of Russian laws is mitigated by the optional character of its implementation. And the second is from, well, a rather modern comedy. And it says, saving drownings is the work of the drownings themselves.
So you're describing a whole cultural history of antagonism between the governing body and the people.
At that time, I don't feel it was this sharp antagonism. It is more just parallel existence.
Uh-huh. Okay. Tell us about psychoanalysis in Moscow. You've created a nice picture of the community at large. Many of us aren't aware of the way psychoanalysis is organized in Moscow, how thriving it is or isn't, and what's happened to it in the present crisis.
I can say that psychoanalysis is quite popular in Moscow, and its popularity has been growing for at least two decades. And supplying demands, the number of psychoanalysts is also growing. The majority is, as they say, wild, but some are, well, I can say domesticated. That is, belong to the two IPA societies. However, I can predict, or just people are afraid, that this favorable situation can change with the pandemic economic crisis and also growing popularity of less demanding cognitive behavioral approach. So a bit about these two IPA societies that we have. One is the Moscow Society of Psychoanalysts. It is component society, and ours, the Moscow Group of Psychoanalysts, is provisional society. Ours is about 40 members, and the other one is twice as big. And usually we are asked, why two? Is it because of different theoretical orientations? And my answer is no. The orientation of the both societies more or less the same and could be described as eclectical. And there is reason for this, because psychoanalysis began to develop here only in the 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And although it was the second start, we had to begin from the scratch. The first Russian psychoanalytic society that existed in 1920s with some well-known analysts such as Sabina Spilrein and Alexander Luria was dispersed in the 30s. Psychoanalysis, together with psychoanalytically informed pedagogy, was forbidden as politically incorrect discipline. So the tradition was lost. And by the time of the second start in 1990s, there weren't any qualified analysts in the country. So the entire first and partly the second generation of today's analysts had their training in different countries and brought back different theoretical orientations. So in our society, there are people with different, well, some with from with different theoretical approaches. So to function as a society, we have to integrate different schools. Sometimes it can be rather challenging, but also, I think, stimulating. And apart from the two IPA societies, there are a number of local psychoanalytical societies and societies for psychoanalytical psychotherapy, and also different institutions of higher education that allegedly provide psychoanalytic training. Some of them are more or less professional. They maintain international connections and invite psychoanalysts from abroad to teach. Others are completely amateurish. In a way, local society do a certain job for our society by making a pool of people interested in psychoanalysis from which we can recruit our future candidates. So we don't experience lack of candidates and every year have enough applicants to choose from them the best. I think it's this overall picture.
That is similar sounding to many programs, speaking here in the States, have psychotherapy training programs. And from them, those programs, the numbers of people then proceed to more in-depth training and they pursue full psychoanalytic training. And you're sort of describing a similar process,
yes,
with these other institutes. The influence of many theoretical models that you're describing is fascinating. Can you give us a feel clinically for what kinds of patients you see, how perhaps the multiple theoretical points of view come together in your work, and how you encounter it with patients dealing with this crisis?
Well, it's not that. Oh, see, I am from the first generation, I think, and it's not that I just integrate in myself different theoretical orientation, because more or less we work in one paradigm. Mm-hmm. When the integration occurs, is in teaching, so because we teaching theoretical seminars, but also just our candidates have different supervisions. For instance, it's object relation school or French school. Yes, maybe these are two main, maybe self psychology a bit. And it's more, sometimes there are problems, I think, not so much with patients, but a bit with supervisions of candidates, when, say, one supervisor is just more, has more, so French school orientation, and another is more object relation, and poor candidates sometimes can't integrate it.
That goes on around the world, of course.
Yeah.
Even if it's from the quote same school, candidates routinely, and all of us in various forms, present the same clinical material to multiple supervisors, and of course get multiple points of view, and use that in one's own defensive structure to either castigate supervisors or to learn. I mean, it's a whole learning process that we're all familiar with. How have your patients dealt with this this situation of not only the lockdown, not only the fears for their health, but also the tensions that you're describing between the media, the government, and the people?
I see. So, of course, it's inevitably that all these changes in the life, the pandemic, the self-isolation has impact on life of all patients. And it affected their habitual lifestyles, disrupted social contacts, and what you said, they were world subjected to unprecedented media pressure. And what I can say that this reality of pandemic was, of course, potent source for fantasy of being attacked from without. And it's no wonder that some patients became disturbed and paranoid and could speak for weeks only about different aspects of the contagion and elaborated measures to defend oneself from it. But for me, at least, it's what was more amazing that there were patients who managed to ignore their pandemic and everything connected with it altogether, and they didn't show any signs of anxiety, concern, or even curiosity about the spreading of the virus, and they remained completely immersed in the usual problems and, say, patterns of feelings. I have already encountered similar reaction of total indifference to events outside, in the outside world, in 1993, during the confrontation between the president and the parliament. At that time, there were shootings in the street. The state of emergency was declared in Moscow, and troops and armored vehicles were sent in. I worked at that time near the building where the members of parliament had barricaded themselves. The sounds of gunfight and tank cannon shots could be heard from the outside. However, some patients managed to completely disregard all of that and kept talking about their personal matters as if nothing had happened.
So there was practically warfare in the streets with tanks and shootings right outside, and you had patients come into your office and make no reference to it.
Yes, and it seems they were not even curious about. You know, when something is happening, they're usually people who are so curious, they disregard the danger, want to see what is happening. No, they were completely indifferent.
And there's a parallel, you're saying, to the patients today, some of whom also are in denial about the real medical crisis that we're all facing.
Yes, and I can say it is a specific form of denial. Usually such patients have intellectual knowledge about what is happening, but they don't invest them emotionally. They're indifferent to the outside world, I can say. And what is interesting, that such patients had no problem with online analysis. They preferred to ordinary and would like to continue having sessions on Skype even after the lockdown is over. And I think it is because analyst on the screen is less real, more close to the internal image. So he or she felt being more under their control. In this way, they avoid contact with the real person and, in a way, simply continue their internal dialogue. And I was told by a colleague about, I think, very telling behavior of a patient of this kind. After the analyst switched off her camera, she would start to behave as if she was invisible, although her own camera was still on. She could walk around the room, do her hair, have coffee, etc. In transference, her analyst often felt reduced to audience, while she played roles of both the patient and the analyst.
And you're saying, you're, in your experience, the online work facilitates that audience position.
Hmm. Yes, yes, even definitely.
And by your and our association in this conversation, I take it that you feel that that's some way linked to the denial, both in the 93 uprising, also in the face of the virus crisis, and also perhaps going back to the beginning of our conversation when you spoke about the disconnect between the government and the people, that there's also a sort of denial that the government is just talking, not really talking with the people, but talking at them as if it's a performance and the people aren't really being engaged by the government pronouncements.
Yes, it seems so that these patients, so not in reality, they don't somehow don't quite differentiate and not interested in reality, not invest in the reality, and they're quite happy being in their internal world. And maybe the government too in this way. They live in one world and the people live in the other. So the patients live in one world and what is happening outside don't bother them very much. And it's about, I think, the avoidance of contact, avoidance of the other.
Yes, that's a very rich example. Thank you for that. Lola, tell us about yourself, if you would. You're describing, obviously, the world is going through a terrible time, and just as each community deals with it differently, we all survive it differently. We all sustain ourselves differently. Can you share with us something about your experience and how you're getting through all this?
Well, just what I think that, well, of course, this pandemic was and lockdown and all the fears and concerns connected with this about oneself and close ones and patients and the necessity to change abruptly to remote mode, it was a very stressful situation. But I think it is not over yet, and there is still a fear of the second wave, and we are still in a state of stress. Yeah. And I think in the state of stress, the main aim is to adapt to the situation and to survive in it. And I think only when it is over and we can relax and breathe out, we'll be able to estimate just how we cope with it and the consequences of this period and also mourn the losses. Just now, I think all personally and as a society, we are just in the state of preparedness. But I think our generation, in a way, is more prepared to such calamities because we survived the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then we lived through several years of complete uncertainty, social chaos, unrest, rise of criminality, etc. But somehow, well, we survived it. And nowadays, I think the main fears or the main anxiety is maybe a bit like in the past with this days after collapse of Soviet Union is what? Is uncertain future. Well, we don't know what. We can't make plans, and the future becomes unpredictable. No one knows whether there will be a second wave. What is all this new normal with masks, social distancing, etc.? And of course, with the predicted economic collapse. So just in this way, it is, well, I think similar to the days of the after the collapse of Soviet Union, because, well, it seems that some new organization of the world will emerge sooner or later, and no one knows what it be like. So just in a way, it is the period of disconnect between times. So the future, unpredictable future, that's, I think, the main anxiety now.
Lola, I want to thank you. I feel like I've been tutored in history in our conversation.
Sorry.
No, I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful both to learn about both the history and the presence in the presence of that history, both going back to the smallpox epidemic and the 93 uprising and the collapse of the government. Speaking for myself and probably many others here in the West, those don't live in our consciousnesses, obviously, like they do for you and your community. And I, and likely others, wouldn't be aware of how that is the context with which you're encountering this crisis. And for example, the collapse of the Soviet Union is something I certainly lived through in the West, but I don't have a feel for how it resembles the collapse of society that in some ways you and we're all facing right now. It wouldn't have occurred to me. Yeah. And so I thank you for sharing that. It elicits in me a sense of respect for your fortitude, and the "your" refers to both you and your community, because it not only are you facing the crisis, but you're also describing facing an alienation with your government. Mm-hmm. Everybody has more or less, but you're describing a more version of your alienation. And so I'm left with high regard and respect for you, the psychoanalytic community, and your people who are facing this in very difficult times. And I'm grateful for your sharing your experience and for teaching us all.
Well, and thank you. It was a pleasure for me just to share my experience. And I'm happy. It is interesting.
Thanks again.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.